Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. Joining me here today from the UBS Chief Investment Office, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, the Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Joining me across the table, his first appearance with us here on How Should I Be Positioned, I'm glad to welcome Ron Temple, the Chief Market Strategist with Lazard Asset Management. So with that, Jason, Ron, thank you both for spending some time today with our listeners and clients here on the podcast. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Happy to be here.
Glad you can join us for the first time.
Thanks.
So maybe beginning big picture, Ron, just looking at the U.S. economy as it stands today and expectations as we look ahead, the trajectory, there's been a lot of debate over whether we're in for a soft landing, a no landing scenario, or perhaps something else. So as we're looking ahead, how do you see the U.S. economy evolving from here?
Yeah, so I think the U.S. economy is in a really good position. You know, we had a bit of a scare over the last few months when we got the July and August job data. They were weaker than expected. But then we got the September data and the prior months were revised upwards. And basically, I looked at that as, you know, it was basically unnecessary alarm in the market. People were too worried about recession risk. And the way I think about the U.S. economy is for the last 2 years, we've been growing faster than most economists would say is a sustainable pace. You know, most economists would say potential growth in the U.S. is 1.7 to 2%. We've been growing closer to 2.5%. We are slowing down, I think, next year and the year after, probably closer to 2% growth. So a good place. If you think about the last 3 years, the whole story has been about the inflation fight. I think the Fed's made a lot of progress there. We've gone from over 9% inflation to around 2.5 on headline, from 6.6 on core to something just over 3. And all through that, you basically got unemployment at 4.05%, which is merely 0.65% above the 54-year low. So it's a pretty good situation. And I think the outlook looks pretty good.
Well, I would echo much of what Ron had said. And sometimes I kind of, as I'm giving our view, I kind of wonder, like, am I too optimistic? What am I missing? Because things seem, from an economic perspective, from a growth perspective, to be, you know, quite good. We were quite on a day when we got the September retail sales data, which it was, again, surprised to the upside. Mm-hmm. It's been sort of the story for the past month. If you look at the core real retail sales data for the third quarter annualized, it's 5.4%. That is a strong sign of consumer spending. It's why tracking estimates for third quarter GDP are around 3%. Consensus is 3%. Yeah. After the second quarter grew at 3%. So we keep talking about moderation, yet it's not really kind of showing up in the economy. And I think, you know, there's not a lot of things that you look at would say there are stresses in the consumer. The household looks solid, business sector looks solid, and now you have the Fed cutting rates. So it's all looks good, which always kind of makes you wonder, like, what am I missing? But I want to kind of maybe, you know, pick up on something like the way that, Dan, you kind of opened the question of, like, soft landing, no landing. In the past 2 weeks, you know, this term no landing has been sort of floated around. These are all subjective and arbitrary definitions. And you said, like, you know, you think the economy will slow. How then do you define, if before potential growth, trend growth is like 1.7, 2%, is that still what you think? Do you think in the medium term, 1-2 years, like, we're actually higher, that we will stay higher? Like, how are you kind of thinking of, like, given that we keep surprising the upside, like, could this continue? Like, is it changing your thinking about all these kind of more medium, longer term factors?
Well, it sounds like the two of us think a lot alike, because I constantly worry, is there something I'm missing? There must be something lurking out there. And if you really think about it, you know, during the period of the pandemic, we had $10.8 trillion of fiscal stimulus globally. 5.3 of that was in the U.S. We had $15 trillion of quantitative easing just from the Fed, the ECB, and the BOJ, not to mention all the other central banks. And I just keep thinking, surely something's got to go wrong. And obviously, we had the inflation surge, but I think that was largely about supply chains and the fact that people had a lot of cash. So when I think about going forward, you know, what's going to make this momentum decelerate, or what's going to slow down the growth rate, I think it is in large part that the consumer has spent the excess savings coming out of the pandemic, right? You might recall the estimates were that people had $2.25 trillion of excess accumulated savings when the pandemic ended. That's about 8%, 9% of GDP at the time. That money's largely gone. And we are seeing signs, by the way, of stress in the lower kind of income wealth categories in the U.S. Let's say the bottom 40% of households. Credit card serious delinquencies, meaning over 90 days past due, are at around 10.5%. That's above the average of the last 14 years since the GFC. And so, you know, there are signs that consumers are having a bit more trouble. And that's part of why I think you're going to get less growth over the next year. Importantly, though, that bottom 40% of the country is 20% of the discretionary spending. So, you know, again, it's not enough to cause recession, but it probably gives you a decreased momentum. And, you know, the good news on the other side of that is 4.05% unemployment rate. Sorry to keep going to the second decimal, but, you know, it was rounded up to 4.1, but it was literally 4.051. So, you know, you've got full employment, you've got wage growth that's greater than inflation. It should be a good economic story. And I see no reason to think there should be a recession. So I think it's interesting. We're all talking about what kind of landing, you know, why would there be a landing? Typically, you have economic cycles that last 7-8 years. We're about 3 years into this recovery from the pandemic.
So on this landing point, like something I wrote earlier in the year, I called it like, maybe we're like a 6% economy. And by that, I mean, nominal GDP growth could be 6%, which is on the optimistic side. But like, you know, if you grow at real GDP at 3%, inflation 3%, you get to 6. Now, I was being kind of pushing the envelope. It's more along the lines of perhaps 5%. Nominal GDP grew 5% in the first half of this year. It's on track to about 5% in the third quarter. And I say this because, like, what do we mean to soft land? I think the assumption that people were making is like, well, we soft land back to potential growth of like the 1.7, 2%. Mm-hmm. We get back to 2% inflation, and therefore nominal GDP growth is 4%. Like, that's sort of implicitly what people are thinking. And maybe like, well, if we can just keep growing at this 5% nominal GDP, maybe that is the landing. So it's like not so much no landing, it's a landing at a different plateau. But it gets into, and this is kind of, I'm leading to a question here, don't worry, is the idea that there's strong demand, and so that could kind of pull back. And there's some assumption like if demand weakens, we'll go back to that 2%. But from a long-term perspective, like ultimately your potential growth is on the supply side of the economy. You could say that immigration has been a big factor that increased labor supply. So for the past year, maybe a little bit longer, supply has been a positive surprise. Productivity data has been looking pretty good. I mean, it's really hard to predict, but there's hype and certainly hope around AI being long-term a productivity increasing tool. So one of my kind of optimistic theses would be like, yep, we're just going to be able to grow at a higher rate just because of the supply side is better and it's not going to be inflationary. So when I think of like a 3 to 5 year view, it's the supply side that I tend to focus on that gives me optimism more so than the demand side. Is that something that you think about? I mean, because you think of like the consumer kind of pulling back. Do you think that trend growth is like understated, at 2% and it could be sustainably higher for a longer period of time?
It's possible. I mean, I think that what you just laid out is entirely plausible and could happen in the U.S. And in part, it depends on government policy. So, it might be a pivot to the election here. But, if you look at the growth in the U.S., I mean, immigration does, has boosted growth. And part of why we've been able to basically have this much growth with inflation decelerating is you've got enough labor supply. And again, I recognize every country should control its borders. But maybe, Australia is a good parallel in this regard. They've gone basically 30 years with no recession, absent that brief window of the pandemic. And part of the reason they haven't had a recession is if you think about potential GDP growth, it's exactly what you went through, right? It's how many hours are worked and how much do you produce per hour? So put differently, what's your working age population growth and what's productivity? And if you have, higher levels of immigration, particularly if you can choose who you let immigrate, you can have a higher growth rate. So there's a possibility that immigration factor could lead to better growth. And there's also a possibility, I think it's too early to make this call, that AI and all of this technology investment could boost productivity. Now, I think it's really early to make that call. I'm a little optimistic on that front, but a lot of people got optimistic in 1999 about the TMT bubble raising productivity, and maybe a decade later it showed up.
So I thought the 90s are, even going back a few years ago, like is the right parallel, not necessarily the 70s. And the way the Fed has hiked is similar to 94, and then they only cut 75 basis points in 95, 96. Maybe they only actually cut 100, 125 basis points, not as much as people think. Like we can say with hindsight that, the rest of the decade became this productivity boom, technology related. Could something happen again this time? I think there's reasons to like make the argument. Again, it's just really hard to predict. You made the, also on the point about Australia, I've made the similar point. Like Australia has not had a recession for many years. Then someone from Australia told me, well, that's true, but on a per capita basis we have, right? So it's a little bit of...
I've said that to some of my LSU friends too. but on the headline level...
It's absolutely true. Yeah. You also touched on the election. Obviously, politics and policy will steer this, good or bad. Kind of thinking more near term in terms of the markets, something that's, I'd say, in the past 2 weeks, it feels like the markets have been moving and sort of indications of like polling data, at least prediction markets putting more probability on Trump winning. Like marginally going from like 47 to maybe 53%. a little bit more probability of a red sweep where the Republicans will get the House and Senate. And then people looking at the markets, whether it's yields rising, baskets of, you know, red sweep winners versus blue sweep winners kind of moving in that direction. You can also say this is just because of the markets looking at better growth data, right? So how much do you think the election and these probability shift is sort of influencing current market action, but then also whatever the result ends up being, how relevant is it to kind of your thesis for, you know, the outlook for the economy, certainly for the next year?
Yeah, I guess a few points on that. Number one, on the betting markets around the election, I spend zero time looking at them because I don't think they're reliable. You know, my understanding is that you basically have a few players who can distort that market. And, you know, again, it gets news because it makes it seem like there's a change in the momentum. But if you really look across all the polls, I mean, which we do carefully, we have a geopolitical advisory business, and this is obviously very important to that business. If you look across all of the polls, maybe you've seen a small shift of, say, 20, 30 basis points in Kamala Harris's lead, you know, from something close to 3% down towards 2.5% in the popular vote nationally. All seven of the swing states have been within the margin of error for weeks now, and that hasn't really changed. And typically, as you get closer to the election, polls do tighten. What's interesting to me is voter turnout is going to drive the outcome of this election. And I did just actually look for this today in Georgia, at least as of our recording date, twice as many people have voted early as in 2020. Now, the hard part is you don't know, are those twice as many people in Atlanta, which is heavily Democratic, or are they out in the rural parts of Georgia, which tend to be more Republican? And so I think this is going to be a really tough election to call. So that would be point number one. Point number two around the election would be also remember that in 2020, 66.8% of eligible voters actually voted, which was the highest since 1900, back to voter turnout. But 70% of those people voted before Election Day. Now, that was extraordinarily high because of COVID. You know, not many of us wanted to go stand in line with a bunch of strangers in November of 2020. So maybe that number ends up being lower this time. But again, that's going to feed into this dynamic in terms of the election. One last point about the election outcome would be my base case is that there's an 80% chance the Republicans win the Senate regardless of who wins the White House. So when we start talking about policy post-election, you basically end up with two primary scenarios. In my view, whoever wins the White House probably wins the House because it means they got out their voters. So you have one scenario where it's a Republican sweep. The other scenario is Kamala Harris with a Republican Senate and a Democratic House. And that could really change the direction of policy. So maybe we can dig into that more if you'd like.
No, I think that's kind of our view. Like it's either, you know, Republicans get the Senate. Our official view is not more than 80%, but like given the polling data, it feels like it's probably higher than that. The Republicans get the Senate because they're going to get West Virginia almost certainly. Montana looks like it's very likely to go that way. That's it, right? That's, you know, nothing else has to happen.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the seven elections, like Joe Manchin's seat, I count as a 99.9% chance mm-hmm. that's going Republican. But if you look across the other seven states where the race is close, every seat's held by a Democrat. So, you know, as you say, John Tester in Montana. He's in a really tough position. And by the way, he's behind well beyond the margin of error. So that seems like a likely pickup. So I'm assuming Republicans have 51 or 52 seats after this election in the Senate.
You mentioned, like, you know, talking about the geopolitical strategists and going back to the early voting numbers. And I've heard the same thing that it's like in Georgia and other places, like it's much higher than it even was in 2020. In 2020, it was Democrats by and large, like predominantly who voted early. Mm-hmm. So, and those votes often aren't counted until like later, like they didn't even start counting like until after the polls closed, maybe not the next day. So as a result, on election night, a lot of cases, Republicans like Trump or on the Senate, you know, were leading. And then as the other votes were counted, the early voting, then it started to swing the other way. On that, so given there's a surge in early voting, does he have a theory, like your political strategist have a theory that this is more being driven by even more Democrats? Any conjectures? Like, you know, there's got to be, you know, political consultants must be like trying to canvas and get a sense of where it's.
Yeah, the only thing I've seen is, for example, an indication that early voting in Virginia seems to be more in Republican leaning districts. In Georgia, I don't know that we have that data. So it's different states, you know, disclosing different types of data. And to your point, so I think it's too early to make a call who's voting. To your point about the voting of the counting of the ballots, I think this election could be very painful to watch. Because Pennsylvania is the best case in point. They started, I think, sending out ballots on September 16th, I believe, is when early voting began there. they have a state law that they cannot start counting any ballots until November 5th. So if you get a very high, you know, proportion of mail-in ballots, they can't even open the envelope or check the signature until November 5th. We're not going to know the results in Pennsylvania for some time. And you're absolutely right about what happened in 2020. You had more Republicans show up in person. Those votes got counted quickly through vote machines. This time, you know, and you did have the narrative shift overnight as those mail-in ballots got counted, that the tide turned. So I think in this case, you know, we might know the election outcome on November 6th, but I'm thinking it's maybe a 50% chance at best. But we'll see. I mean, maybe the polling's all wrong. I mean, one last thing on polling. I do keep wondering, you know, the polling entities always try to correct for the past mistakes of 2016, 2020. But it's really hard to predict, you know, let's use Arizona. Right now, Trump's ahead in Arizona by a point. There's a constitutional referendum in Arizona on abortion rights. In every other state where you've had that referendum, you know, you've had a pretty sizable turnout amongst women. And we all know that Kamala Harris is leading Trump by, I think, 13 to 15 points of women. So even there, I wonder, do the polls adjust for that likely demographic complexion of the turnout? I don't know how they could.
We don't know, really, I guess, until we actually get the results. So, and probably we won't know on the 6th, the Wednesday, I think last, it was on the Saturday, like 4 days later, when Pennsylvania, I think, was called. You know, it looked likely, but it was until it was like officially done. I remember, like, you know, hearing, you know, like, you know, the response, people outside, so, you know, talking about it. Given sort of then think about the investment implications and, you know, the scenario later, like, it's likely either red sweep or divided government. How does that impact your thinking of, you know, the outlook overall? Or is it more like, okay, this might have certain sector specific or bond markets, like yield curves could change? Like, where, how, in what ways is your investment view broadly across markets or more specifically impacted by the election outcome?
Well, very importantly, historically, if we'd had this conversation 4 years ago or 8 years ago, I probably would have said, don't spend too much time worrying about the presidential election. And let's be honest, historically in the United States, a change in president hasn't really changed the economic trajectory radically. And that might sound kind of crazy because going from an Obama administration to a Trump administration, you would think a big shift. But growth had been accelerating through the second Obama term, and it accelerated a bit more under Trump. And I would just remind people, there's no causal relationship that the day after the inauguration, suddenly you get credit for or blame for everything that happens in the economy.
Except in political circles.
Except in political circles where they own everything that's good and someone else owns all the bad. So I think historically, I would say it's not that impactful. But in this case, I think it really is. And to answer your question, I think it has implications for exchange rates, yield curves, and equity markets and sectors. So it's all of the above. And the reason I say that is when I think about what's market moving about the election, it's three topics. It's trade, taxes, and regulation. And trade is the one that's the real reason I just made such a kind of forceful statement about the implications is Donald Trump has campaigned actively on a platform of a 10% tariff on all imports into the U.S. globally and a 60% tariff on imports from China. And before I go further, I will acknowledge that might be part negotiating position, but I also do not believe those tariffs would happen on day one, and I don't think it would start with going from the current tariff rate on Chinese products to 60 in a single step. But I do think it's very unwise to assume it's not going to happen. And a lot of the investors I talk to globally, and in the last month and a half, I've been in Europe, Australia, Middle East, Asia, all around the world, they're like, well, that's not going to happen. It's bluster. They say these things on the campaign trail. I'm highly confident that Trump is very serious about tariffs. He put tariffs in place in his first term. You might recall there was a list one, list two, list three, 4A, and 4B. We got all the way through list 4A. And if you talk to people, as I've done, who've worked in the Trump administration last time, including in Robert Lighthizer's group, which he led the trade discussions, they've been working for the last 4 years figuring out how they do this right this time. And to them, doing it right means putting those tariffs in place because their goal is twofold. Number one is to kind of limit China's growth and its, you know, expansion as a potential threat to the U.S. But number two, it's to reduce the trade deficit. And Trump's team thinks you can reduce the trade deficit with tariffs, which I think, by the way, fundamentally is wrong because it's probably going to lead to higher U.S. interest rates and a stronger U.S. dollar. We can come back to that. But those tariffs, I'll try to wrap this up. If you look at the economic forecast, including UBS's own forecast, you know, if you did the 10% global and 60% tariff on China, U.S. inflation could go up 2 to 3 percentage points for the year after the tariffs are enacted, and it's 1 year. U.S. GDP could be 100 basis points weaker. Chinese GDP, based on UBS's estimates, would go down by 2.5 percentage points if the U.S. put in a 60% tariff. And Eurozone GDP from another firm basically would be 100 basis points lower with a 10% tariff. So you put all this together, there's a real economic impact. Now, that's part one of the answers. Taxes. There's a partial positive there, right? Because Trump has talked about cutting the corporate tax rate from 21% to 15%. The estimates I've seen say that would raise S&P earnings about 4 percentage points. And then the third area is regulation. Trump has talked a lot about, and if you look at the Republican platform, in multiple cases, it talks about needing more domestic energy production, in particular fossil fuels. Trump has talked for years about increasing drilling on federal lands, increasing the number of permits for LNG exports. So you could see that being a positive for the fossil fuel sector. And then last but not least, financial services. Under Biden slash Harris, there's this progress with the Fed to move towards Basel III endgame, which requires another 5 to 10% capital for the biggest banks in the U.S. That probably would not happen under Trump. And Republicans since 2009 have wanted to eliminate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. That agency recently proposed a late fee limit on late fees for credit cards of $9. That proposal would cost six banks $4.5 billion a year of revenue. Republicans would likely try to defund or even eliminate the CFPB if they control the House and the Senate, the White House. So you can imagine tying this all together. If you get these large tariffs, you're talking about potentially $400 billion a year of tariff revenue. You use some of that for the corporate tax cuts. And basically, when I think about what that does to the economy, it means the Fed can't be cutting rates because you've just raised inflation. So that means the rate cuts don't happen. Yield curve probably moves higher. Dollar probably strengthens because you get more rate cuts outside the U.S., fewer rate cuts in the U.S. And within the equity market, energy stocks go up, financial stocks go up. Why? They don't pay any tariffs. They don't import anything. But their corporate tax rate goes down, the regulations get lighter. Who loses? Consumer discretionary probably suffers. Parts of the tech hardware ecosystem suffer. Some of the industrial companies suffer because a lot of our industrial companies import the components that go into the final goods. So this to me is a market moving election. And by the way, I've only talked about Trump because if Harris is president and has a Republican Senate, she isn't getting anything through the legislature that's going to materially change the story. So I tend to think it's more of the same under Harris, and it's quite a significant disruption globally and within the U.S., positive and negative if it's Trump.
It's wider variance for sure.
Absolutely.
Or larger variance. What you said regarding the late fees and how much it would cost banks. I'm not a single issue voter. That might be my single issue that I vote on. I'm not sure which way I go working for a bank. I think I can see both sides.
I can say confidently UBS is not one of the six banks.
Yes, well, that I know that. For sure. Not in the U.S., certainly. It is, I think that, you know, the bottom of my takeaway is that even if Trump wants to on tariffs, even if he doesn't do as much, or like, you know, the comments from people overseas, the markets initially, I think now, having experienced the first time, would be like, we will move first and sort of ask questions later. I think there's definitely sort of at a minimum volatility.
Yeah, I mean, if I could add one other thing, I do think what's interesting here is, by the way, if you look at it at a global level, I think the impact, immediate impact of an election of Trump, I think the market would probably rally. But it would be those sectors, you know, like financials and energies that would probably lead that rally. But I do think over time, and I'm not sure how long it would take, markets right now are not pricing the trade issues at all in my mind. And so part of the reason I'm talking about this is I do think as investors, it makes sense to kind of pre-plan. If it does look like things are breaking in favor of Trump, maybe you want more exposure to the U.S. in those certain sectors that could be winners. You might want a little less exposure to non-U.S. But I would also suggest if the market really does start to price this and you get a big sell-off in emerging markets or a sell-off in Japanese equities, that might be a buying opportunity. So I think you want to be prepared because I don't think it's priced into markets now, but you might get some interesting entry points for longer-term positions if you do get that kind of sell-off.
There'll be noise to try and extract like what's driving what, which is when I think about what's happened this year, and I've often say, you know, in terms of rank order importance, what's driving markets, like to me, like 1A and 1B high up here is, you know, the Fed and economic data, like the economic data driving things and the Fed responding like that, to me has by far been the biggest driver. Sort of, you know, a notch down would be AI, like that whole story, because NVIDIA now, when it has any sort of news, it literally moves markets on a macro way. And then much, much lower on the scale has been kind of the outcome of the election. Now, that's certainly getting heightened in the near term, but I'm also skeptical on the fiscal front, like even if it is a red sweep, the binding constraint is to me is the number 6.5, which is the deficit to GDP. when Trump was elected, and it was 2.8% in 2016. So he could do fiscal expansion. I think it just, and that assumes, by the way, the 6.5% it continues in time with all the tax cuts expiring. So anything that continues, like if you extend it, it just raises the deficit. And I do think that there's a greater possibility that the markets won't like it and won't be quite as positive. He won't do as much, or just won't be able to do as much. And like the again, the impact comes down to ultimately, what is the economy doing? I absolutely agree that, you know, the trend of the economy sort of overrides necessarily change in policies. Like I yesterday or a couple of days ago, saw a chart that looked at in the 2010s, like what was the economic expansion? The line was basically did not inflect at any point from in 2016. It was kind of going straight higher. And so I think the trend right now for the U.S. economy is good. The private sector is healthy. We're talking tenths of a percent of GDP growth, not kind of changing that dynamic overall, not really impacting the AI productivity story much overall. So a lot of focus on it, but I think it's kind of ultimately, once we get past this, I think we kind of go back to focusing more on these kind of broader trends of where is the economy going. And yes, this will spend a lot of time on it, but I think it's less of a driver than, you know, than the amount of time that we spend on it, which I know we're close to out of time. But sort of abstracting from that, we've talked about the macro. I think we're kind of in agreement. Like, you know, the macro looks good. We kind of wonder what could go wrong. But given all that, what are kind of some of the things that, you know, outlook for equities, U.S., other markets, you know, how investors should be positioned?
Yeah, no. So I'm glad you brought up the deficit, by the way, because regardless of who wins this election, I don't see either party seriously trying to tackle the deficit. And I'm glad you brought up the tax cut expiration, because the Congressional Budget Office assumes you're going to get an extra $330 billion a year starting in 2026. It's not going to happen under either candidate because, you know, Trump would probably extend all those tax cuts. Kamala saying she'll extend 98.2% of them, meaning everyone under 400,000. So that is important. So when I piece it all together, when I think about interest rates, you know, let's take the status quo, which effectively implies a Harris victory, because I think there are different paths under different election outcomes. My view is the Fed cuts rates to maybe 3.5% on Fed funds. Maybe it's 3.5 to 4. Because again, if the economy is doing this well, the Fed's going to be reluctant to cut rates down to, say, 2.5 or 3, because there's a risk of reigniting inflation and there's no reason to basically be cutting aggressively when unemployment's at 4. So that leads me to think the 10-year yield should probably be around 4.25 to 4.5%. It's fair value. So a bit above where we are today, 20 to 40 basis points. So I'm a little more positive on shorter duration instruments, because I think you're going to be better off from a yield perspective in that, to say, 2 to 5 year part of the curve. I also do prefer higher credit quality in the credit space, partly because if I'm wrong, it's that the economy is going to end up being worse than I expect. I don't see a high likelihood of a 3% real GDP number. I can easily foresee a 1%, especially if you have a trade war under, you know, a different election outcome. In the equity market, you know, I think the U.S., you know, has outperformed other markets for so long. I mean, I think, A, we should all be aware that can't go on forever. But I do think, considering the risk around the election, trade war, policy changes, U.S. is probably a better place to be in the near term, because if we do have a trade war, it hurts non-U.S. companies and countries more than it hurts the U.S. Interestingly, one part of the market that I think could do well regardless of the election is small cap. In a status quo, if the Fed's cutting rates further, small cap companies have twice the debt of large cap companies and 45% of its floating rate. Only 10% of the S&P 500 debt is floating rate. So they get the benefit there. But if you don't get those rate cuts because you're in a trade war and inflation's higher, small cap companies get 90% of their revenue domestically. So they have less of a foreign customer base where there could be retaliation involved, more domestic supply chain. So that could be an insulated part of the market. And then I do think, you know, in terms of geographies, looking out over the next 2-3 years, you know, maybe you get a sell-off depending on the election outcome, but I do think Japan is a really interesting place to be. I do think the long-term EM story is getting more interesting, and this might be where you debate whether you do EM with China or EM without China, because I see one trend regardless of the election, which is companies trying to de-risk relative to China, and what they're talking about with us is where do we go instead of China? And it's not South Carolina or Spain. It's, is it India? Is it Mexico? Is it Thailand? It's other EMs. So I think you're going to see growth accelerate in a lot of the rest of the EM world, regardless of who wins. And by the way, if it's Trump and you got 60% tariffs on China, that might accelerate that trade. So I think there's some really interesting opportunities there. And then last but not least, what I should have started with is I think in periods where you have a lot of uncertainty, it's a reminder that you should always probably own the highest quality companies. Now, by the way, not many people probably come in here and say buy garbage companies. But I think what you want to own is quality, but you want to be really careful that you're getting it at the right valuation, because if you overpay for any asset, you're going to lose money.
So I don't want to besmirch all small caps as low quality companies, but for a period of time earlier this year, we recommended small caps and it didn't work. And then all of a sudden, like for 3 weeks in July, it worked spectacularly well. So what I sort of find a little bit challenging with small caps is almost more like it's something that people want to trade for a short bit of time and not necessarily want to invest. And so if you can trade it and be optimal about it, great. That's a really difficult thing to do. So in an environment where, as you described, growth is good, the Fed's cutting rates, this should be good for small caps, other cyclicals. The debate I was even have sort of with myself but other colleagues is that sufficient? Or, people again sort of like date it briefly, trade it briefly, but ultimately you're going to stick with the quality companies. I think, the right call this year has been kind of going quality as opposed to cyclicals. Mm-hmm. That may change if, again, the macro looks benign, but I think things have to go really well consistently to have a sustained move higher for small cap cyclicals, maybe even EM to some extent, until people are truly convinced like we've landed this plane, inflation solved, this expansion has no sort of end, like we're mid-cycle, whatever it is, like with no end near, which I think could certainly materialize. But until that happens, I'm skeptical that the markets, having maybe been burned by it, that this is going to sort of be able to sustain rotation.
No, I generally agree with everything you said. I'm really glad you brought up the quality issue in small cap. I mean, I think you definitely want to engage this from an active perspective, not a passive, because 40% of the Russell 2000 loses money. So, I think 90% of the biotechs, for example, in the Russell 2000 lose money. And I think most people would agree that's one of the more inefficient parts of the market where you probably have an advantage being active, whereas for large caps, it's been a really hard place to be active over the last decade or more.
Well, Ron, Jason, you've both been very generous with your time, very insightful as we're heading into Election Day. Sounds like we need to have a part two once we have more clarity on the outcome. So, Ron, would be great to have you back as we look ahead to next year. Though, Jason, Ron, thank you both for spending some time today with our listeners, our clients, here on How Should I Be Positioned.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.